My name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland.
Okay, look, I know it's a little windy. I moved to a different spot this week. I may have to kind of adjust myself. I'm sitting under a tree in the wind down here at what is called the Greenbelt Park. It's on Mud Island, looking at the Mississippi River. There's a barge out there in the river. Those of you who have never seen the Mississippi River would be probably a bit surprised as to really what it kind of looks like. It's big. It's down a little bit, down quite a bit actually. It brings me to kind of what I wanted to talk about this time around, which is about preconceived notions, perceptions, and things like that. And I use the river as a prime example of this sort of thing. For those that are the uninitiated, the Mississippi River, of course, is the longest river in North America, or so the books would have us believe, and it's probably true. And it's pretty wide in a lot of places. I don't think there's too many people that can drive a golf ball across, at least this part of it down here. I am on the western edge of the state of Tennessee, looking across the river is the great state of Arkansas. And this is probably one of the most scenic spots down here, aside from the wind and all. And if this wind keeps up, I'll keep this brief, so you know you can move along about your time. But here's the thing. When you have in your mind, when somebody talks about the river, talks about the Mississippi River, if you've never seen it, you have a thing in your head as to what it would be like, a bunch of paddle boats, you know, steam-powered paddle boats, people singing zippity-doo-dah up and down the damn river, Mark Twain, you know, Tom Sawyer, that whole romantic notion of what the river is actually about, or was about. Certainly not that anymore. I mean, you've got diesel boats going up and down this damn thing 24 hours a day, hauling stuff from here to there, and goods and services and things like that. And, of course, it ends not far from here, down in the Gulf of Mexico. But here's the thing. Whatever you have in your mind about this river down here in Memphis, scratch that. First of all, it's brown. It's a brown river. And, yes, there are people that fish out of this damn thing. I don't fathom consuming any creature that was caught out of this river. With the amount of lead and metals and toxins and oils and grease and crap that's in this river, I could not for the life of me imagine eating that. I know they pull some big fish out of here too, and I guess if you're a fisherman in the sport of it would be you know stellar. It'd be awesome. But I think these fish down here have sort of mutated into something that would be far beyond anything edible, at least that you would want to put on a plate. And you know what? The wind here has gotten so bad, and I think it's just going to be intolerable here, that I'm just going to have to pick up and make my way back to the car, and we'll finish this behind the wheel of the car. How about that? We can do that. Because I wanted to talk about perceptions and notions and things like that. So, bear with me, and we'll continue on. We'll pick up here in just a moment. Okay, so I've had to leave the park, obviously. It was incredibly windy down there along the river. But what I wanted to get into was this thing about perceptions and preconceived notions and things of that nature. There's a thing. There's, you know, we all do it. We have this mental image in our minds as to what we expect something to be like. The best way I can describe it is this. Back when I lived in South Texas, I used to go to this. There were several of them. These little restaurants. They're fast food Mexican joints in San Antonio called Taco Cabana. Those of you down there that listen to this podcast know exactly what I'm talking about. And there was a couple of them that I frequented, and it would be one of these places that you would go to, you know, late at night, after you've been drinking, you've been out on the town, you're ready to go home, you're ready to, you know, find a television and a place to prop your feet up and eat some bean and cheese tacos. Those of you who are familiar with the Taco Cabana bean and cheese taco phenomenon would know exactly what I'm talking about. Absolutely wonderful, divine food. And cheap, oh my God, and 24 hours a day. Well, and they had, you know, several other dishes, of course, too. And there was this one that I used to go to. It was on San Pedro Avenue. I can't think of the cross street. It's been so long since I've been there. But the idea was that, sometimes for lunch I might zip in real quick. They had a drive-through. If I wanted to go there, I could, you know, grab a park, go inside, have a bite to eat, grab a nice little plate of something that was a little more substantial, and, go to town. And there was this one hot afternoon where I was really craving one of their dishes, and it was a chicken dish, and it had this wonderful guacamole that I would get on the side. And the guacamole was absolutely tremendous. And I stopped into the one over there on San Pedro. I know San Pedro's a long street, but it was somewhere kind of downtown, midtown. And I it was one of these that you almost had to drive around the back to get into the front, which I did. And as I drove by there, it was a hot July afternoon. And there was this gentleman that was back there who was seated upon a 5-gallon bucket. He was down to his undershirt, you know, the sleeveless, the British call them vests. The Italians would call them the Italian dinner jacket. I think you know what I'm talking about. And he's sitting there in his jeans and his boots, and he's got his white sleeveless wife beater, if you will, because it's, you know, hot. And he's making up a batch of guacamole. And why he was making it outside is beyond me. But in front of him, he had another 5-gallon bucket that was, of course, open at the top. And he had a big paddle in his hand, and he was making, you know, stomping up the avocados. And he had all of his other stuff that he was making in there to go with it. And he had a butt going with some very long ashes on it, of which some fell into the guacamole. And that wasn't so alarming as much as the fact that it was, you know, 127 degrees outside, and this man was dripping sweat all down into the top of the guacamole bucket. Yeah, I didn't stop in there for lunch. In fact, I hadn't really gone back to eat there ever since. It wasn't too long after that I wound up moving here to Memphis, but still. Jumping, Jesus, that was a thing. But it goes, in a way, to preconceived notions, and what's that about? For another example, now this is much more pleasant. When one of the favorite places that I like to attend or go to, speaking of food, or are Indian restaurants. I absolutely love them. I've been to several here in town. Some are better than others. But there's none of them that are really, you know, bad. They're all pretty good. That's the kind of the cool thing about them. And when I go in there and I have a seat, there's that whole mystique thing, you know, you got the buffet, and of course the smells are just divine. And the whole, you know, the music that's playing over over their little radios, their sound system thing over there, which is, you know, the lovely sitar music and everything that is just wonderful like that. And the waiter, he comes around. Of course, it seems to me that all the waiters in Indian restaurants are all wearing a long sleeve dress shirt with a tie, and they've got their hair kind of slicked back, and they're very clean, and they're very nice people. And they bring out the water, and then they start bringing out the flatbread, and they point you to the buffet, and your mouth begins to water at the very thought of just diving into some of that lovely curried stuff and the fried potatoes and all that. Oh my God, some really wonderful things. And I always have in my mind this, I don't know, I guess it's sort of a romantic notion, if you will, that what's going on behind the public eye over there, behind closed doors, if you will. In my mind, in the kitchen is some little old lady who spent her formative years in India, of course, because that's, you know, where she learned to cook like this. And she's slaving away back there for guys like me at $8 a plate. Well, $8 a, not a plate, but $8 a time you go in. It's cheap. And there's like this love and care and attention that has been placed into this food. Because that's what they all do, right? The recipes vary from restaurant to restaurant. Vindaloo chicken at one place is going to taste completely different than the Vindaloo chicken at another. That's just how it goes with foreign cuisines, because these are family recipes, of course. And you have this whole notion that, that this little old lady is back there just working her ass off. And, you know, every so often you'll see one of the guys come out of the kitchen, and he's got the apron on, and he's got a new tray of, you know, vindaloo chicken, and he's taking it down to the buffet because everybody's been sopping it up. And you're thinking that poor woman back there is just up to her ninnies in vindaloo chicken back there. And she's probably smiling the whole way. She's like 83 years old and loves doing this. Well, the fact of the matter is really, quite frankly, this, that there is no little old lady in the back of one of these restaurants that's cooking away. It just doesn't happen like that. I'm sure it happens in some occasions, but for the most part, no, it's not that at all. It's like the owner's brother and his son. And he has no idea how to make vindaloo chicken, but his brother is going to teach him how to do it. Hey, whatever works, right? Whatever keeps the doors open. Next customer that comes in with $8 is going to eat well. And that's just how it works. But that's the perceptions. That's the preconceived notions that sometimes that we have when we either go to a place or we have it. Like, for example, when you go to get on a plane and you're going to be flying to a city you've never been to but you've often heard about, you always have this notion of what it's going to be like. And then when you get there, of course, it's nothing like that at all. That's not a bad thing. It's just, that's just the way it is. We always set ourselves up for something that you think is going to be, you know, cool and groovy, when actually it's nothing like that at all. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. When I sit down to, you know, work on various projects with Radio Memphis, it often starts the same way. I'm working on a whatever project it is, and I usually will have my Moleskine book. If you're not familiar with Moleskine books, I do highly recommend them. They're not a paid sponsor on this program, although if you'd like to, you're more than welcome to get in touch with me and be one. Moleskine is great. M-O-L-E-S-K-I-N-E. They're not made with the skin of moles. No, they're not like that. It's kind of a faux leather-bound black book. They do come in various colors, but I always get the black ones. And they have lined and unlined pages. They have this little cool elastic strap that holds everything together. They're not very big, but they're the perfect size to fit in a briefcase or a shoulder bag or, you know, your man bag, whatever you want to call it. And they're perfect for making notes, and I use them every day. And I'll often sit down and I'll have a cocktail handy, and I'll think, okay, something's brewing up in my old head here. And, you know, I'll see if I can knock it loose with a few shots of whiskey, and maybe I'll be able to take a few notes. And then from there, an idea is germinated and somewhat born, and things start to come together, and I have different ideas, and my notes begin to spread out. And then when I go to put them in play, well, things begin to change a little bit. And it happens with everybody. It happens all the time. Every time you have come up with an idea to put something down to create, whether it's something for your job or your school or whatever the case may be, and as you get in there and you get to doing all this, it changes. It changes just by the act of, you know, doing it. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that's just how that happens. So very rarely, whatever it is that you conceive actually comes out to be, you know, the final product never matches the perceived idea behind it. I used to be really frustrated by that sort of thing, and now I've kind of gotten to the point where I've sort of embraced it, and I use it to my advantage. Sorry, my voice cracked. I sounded like Bobby Brady. It's part of the process. It's part of the creativity that goes on in people's minds and what they're working on. As you begin to work on various things and you lay them out on paper and you try and map things out and you come up with a plan, very rarely full plans actually just come to fruition. It's just, you know, when it does, and that's great, and that's a wonderful thing to have happen. But you're not the A-team. It's not going to always be that way, and you got to be able to improvise along the way. And certainly with what Radio Memphis has done, there's been a lot of improvisation, which is fine. Well, look at this podcast, for example. I've gone into this thing starting at the Mississippi River, and right now I'm somewhere near the center of the damn city just because I'm out driving around and I'm talking to you because I thought it was too windy. Here's the thing. It makes a lot of sense to be driving around in my car with the windows down, doesn't it? It's another edition of an idiot driving around in a car. Kind of a running gag we have around in this town. There's always the ship of fools, but here in Memphis, there's always a car of idiots. Actually, that was lifted from Gary Larson, a great illustrator and writer of The Far Side. But I digress. Having a preconceived notion of something is a very healthy thing to have happen. But what's not healthy is being disappointed when it doesn't always come out the way you've expected it to. Oh my God, here's a prime example. Benchmark whiskey. Oh my Jesus. You see it in a bottle and it looks like whiskey. Somebody pours it up into a glass, it smells like whiskey. It smells a lot like it. When you go to taste it, holy jumping Jesus, it's like varnish. Shit's nasty. I forgot who even made it. There's a funny story behind that. I asked Doug one night. He was headed over to a liquor store. I said, hey, do me a favor. I gave him 10 bucks. I said, give me a decent, you know, ass pocket of some type of whiskey. A decent. Don't screw me around. Give me some Jim Beam or something. Something that's, you know, relatively inexpensive. And, you know, that's not horrible. He comes back with this black-labeled Benchmark, which proudly states that it's been aged for at least 36 months. Fucking stellar. And, of course, I'd never heard of this stuff, and I crack open the bottle, and I take a whiff. Well, this isn't so bad. It was only $4. That was should have been my first clue. But, by God, once the taste got... Oh, you know, and it was actually so damn sneaky that when you got it into your mouth on that first taste, when it sits on your tongue and it's like, hey, this is okay, I think I can do okay with it, and you're breathing with it in your mouth and you're doing everything that a good, I guess, a sommelier is supposed to do. But when you go to swallow it, it fights you all the way down. It fights you all the way down. That's a good example of a preconceived notion gone horribly wrong. Just because it looks and smells and sort of tastes like it doesn't mean it's actually what it is supposed to be. I mean, you could call it whiskey, quotes, you know, end quote. But, you know, it wasn't meant to be consumed in the way that it was. And, of course, being the trooper that I was, I had to choke every drop of it down. Because that's just what you do. Crazy, I know. But I also have some other ideas in here, and I was just thinking earlier when I was, you know, headed down to the river to do this podcast, which turned out completely disastrous. I think it would be kind of cool is, you know, is to play around with people's perceptions a little bit, and it would be a really cool way to do this, and I'll need to get a few folks together, and I think we can do this. I need to sit down and really kind of map it out, and it wouldn't take much for me to do this. But one of those old-fashioned, old-school radio dramas. I'll see if I've got somebody who's already got one written. If not, I'll write one myself. We'll get some voices in there, sound effects, and things like that. And here's the thing. It would start off as a process, and I think what I would have to do is document it from the very beginning all the way through to explain how the whole idea of perception gets just so knocked out of whack as you go along. So then when you go back and you look at the final product, and then you go... You have the final product and you go back and you look at the way it was all conceived, you'll see that there's usually a night and day difference. And would it have been better to go with the original idea, or you just go with the wind and see what happens down the way? Sometimes I think you really kind of have to go with what's happening down the way because, you know, I do believe to a certain extent that Providence does throw their hands in things. Now, am I saying divine intervention? No. You want more on that? Go look for Abigail Noel and her podcast. It's in the series. But I'm certainly not, you know, going to say that. And I know she'd kick me in the ass if she heard this. But I think that yes, to a certain extent, there is this free will thing that goes on, and I don't think that there is, you know, I don't think God's hand is getting involved directly into either a podcast or anything like that, because if that was the case, this episode would certainly be a lot better than what you people are hearing right now. You know, also when it comes to, you know, I don't know, preconceptions, preconceived notions, that kind of, you know, perception of this, I think there's a lot of imagination that has to come into play into that, really. I mean, if I was invited to a wild game dinner where somebody was serving elephant, and let's just say I entertained the idea for just a moment that, you know, maybe having a bite of an elephant really just isn't such a bad thing because, you know, I'm sort of curious. That elephant might be, you know, something that's kind of up my back. Now, look, let's be honest. Do I really have any idea of what elephant would taste like? No. I could probably imagine it being a lot like a different, I don't know, different things. It probably tastes like chicken for all I know, because everything that is in a wild game dinner, they always tell you, well, it's this lovely javelina, and it tastes sort of like pork, but a lot like chicken. Try this squirrel, it tastes like chicken. Try this rattlesnake, it tastes like chicken. Everything fucking tastes like chicken. Of course, nowadays, chicken doesn't even taste like chicken, which is kind of sad. But you have this idea in your mind of what, you know, what a taste of this, I don't know, lovely, lightly roasted or grilled elephant would taste like. And a nice, lovely lemon pepper glaze. I don't know. I don't think I could imagine it too well. Those of you who have actually consumed some elephant, I don't know, tell me. Let me know. Because now I'm kind of curious. I don't know that I would actually eat any of it. I know there's that whole legal thing because they're an endangered species, blah, blah, blah. Okay, great, whatever. The way things are going now, humans are about to be endangered as well. But the idea that that one would consume an elephant is, well, you got to be hungry, and I guess it would feed a lot of people. But what's it going to taste like? What can we imagine it would be like? Well, you know, you have a notion in your mind that you would expect it to be. I would think it's probably a bit greasy. I don't know. That'll be a question I'll never really properly have the answer for, so I'm just going to leave that at bay. However, there is this whole thing about, you know, when you hear stories about people that got into situations where desperate things had to happen, acts of desperation, if you will. The Donner Party is one of them. Remember the movie Alive with Ethan Hawke about the Peruvian rugby team, whether it were, or soccer team, or whatever it was. But anyway, it didn't matter what they played. They crashed in the Andes down in Chile. And they were stranded up there for so long that they wound up eating each other. You know, somebody would die, they'd bury the bodies in the snow to preserve them, and then they would, like, cut off a bit of thigh here and there, and they'd dry out the meat, if you will, and on the wing of the airplane, and then they would consume them. Cannibalism. Whether by desperation or not, I mean, cannibalism is still cannibalism, I know. But there's always that question that's nagging you in the back of your mind when you hear these stories or see these movies or read these books about these situations, and you just go, oh my God, I can't imagine what it would be like to be in a situation like that. That'd be horrible. Not nearly as horrible is the simple fact that there's gonna be a part of you, and it's doing it right now. You're trying to suppress it in your own mind. You're trying to keep this, you know, quelled, if you will. You're trying to keep this at bay. It's part of your dark subconscious that is nagging at you right this very second. And it is this. What on earth must I taste like? What does human people taste like? Human people. You know that question's going around in your head, as disgusted as you may very well be, and as taboo of a subject as it certainly is. It's a valid question. I mean, I know you're stranded in the Andes. You haven't eaten a proper meal in, I don't know, weeks, days, months. I don't know. And you find yourself in a position where you're trying to really sort of, you know, wrap it around in your mind exactly what it is that you're going to do to survive. It's not like you can go down to the corner store and buy yourself something to eat. Because it's just not going to be that way. However, Tim has fallen ill and looks like he's not going to make it. He's dying of hypothermia and exposure. And he passes away. And his last words to you are this: eat me. not the way I just used it, my friend, but the idea that he would say to you that upon my passing, should you find it necessary to, you know, consume me to stay alive, then by all means, allow yourself that freedom to do so. So you've now got permission to do this. You're desperate. You've already said no, because, you know, everything in your conscience, everything in your psyche is telling you that everything about this is just horribly wrong. You cannot, in good conscience, take your old buddy Tim and take a knife to his ass and cut off a bit of a fillet and throw him on some grill of some sort. I don't know, but you're pretty hungry, right? Because you know damn well that if you survive this ordeal and you come home and somebody, I don't know who, but somebody is going to ask you how you survived, and you tell them the truth. My friend Tim died, and his last words to me were, "Eat me." And so I did. And you know what the next question is going to be, don't you? From the reporter or from the police or from the doctors that are examining you, they're going to pull you aside and they're going to have this whole off-the-record thing with you. And they're going to say, look, maybe you can help settle a debate we're having down in the break room right now. What the fuck does Tim taste like? What the fuck does a person taste like? You know, I've never engaged in a cannibalistic practice. I mean, not on that level, but here's the thing. There was one of the guys that was in the Andes. I can't think of his name right now. A rather famous individual who survived the ordeal. And yes, who engaged in the cannibalism to survive. He freely admitted it. And, of course, was exonerated of any crime. I mean, what do you do to somebody that way? You can't put them on trial for anything. For Christ's sakes, they were just trying to keep alive. Under extreme circumstances, it's not like they would take in the neighbor downstairs to show them their etchings, and then the next thing you know, a cheese plate with some of Fred shows up. Nothing like that at all. That would just be disgusting. But, in the point of survival, then, you know, this has to be considered. And it was for this guy. And he was naturally asked, well, what do people taste like? And the answer probably will not shock you in any way, shape, or form. But he claimed that we taste like pork. The other white meat. Which, it makes sense now that you think about it. Grilled, fried, bone-in, whatever you want to call it. We have this sort of a pork consistency. Which is, see, and this brings up another thing that is a bit weird. Pigs have about as much human DNA in them as nearly humanly possible. Because, you got to remember, back around the, 1860s, 1870s, a lot of bad people used to dispose of dead bodies by throwing them in with the pigs. Well, over time, these pigs would, you know, they would consume these people, and their, you know, the people's genetics wind up in being part of the pigs, and et cetera, et cetera. And as things progress along, then, you know, now pigs are pretty much related to people. So I guess if you really want to have an idea of what people taste like, I would probably suggest that the next time you tie into a lovely rack of ribs or a pork chop, bone in probably, because I'm told that's really where the best flavor is. It is very much akin to what you're having if you were eating your neighbor. Yeah, there you go. That's a little something that's been rattling around in my head for a long time. So now that I've dropped that into your lap, I hope that you enjoyed that as much as I had enjoyed telling you that very creepy story. So there. Dig it.
Here's what's coming up on the next edition from Radioland.
Yeah, well, we've all heard those arguments about that, you know, that, oh, I can't believe so-and-so said this or so-and-so said that, and, you know, all these other things are being said and done, and look at these pictures, and oh my God, those shoes. Doesn't know that he's actually still got 15 feet behind him to back up even further, so he doesn't have to put it in drive and go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until he can finally get out of the space. Every time you see on the local news that they've got some type of surveillance footage that they're going to show you because they're looking for somebody, it's always really grainy. You ever notice that? It's like it could be Bigfoot for all we know. So quite frankly here, kids, what we've learned about this is that if you smoke pot, Tony Stewart will kill you. There's nothing you can do about it either. That's the thing about it. That's the really fucked up part about it. There's nothing you can do. Wherever you go, you're being watched.
Radio Memphis is an internet broadcasting service provided by PirateRadioStudios.com, Memphis, Tennessee, USA.
Once again, our thanks to everybody who has become a subscriber to this podcast. A good number of you have, and I know it's kind of interesting to see how some of the episodes fare. They go up, they go down, they go in, they go this way, they go that way. It's really kind of interesting to see that what people are kind of saluting or not as far as what gets run up the old flagpole. However, we're going to continue to do them, as you just heard in the tease from the from what's coming up next time around. So once again, my thanks to all of you who have done it. And I did mention sponsor. It was sort of a Freudian slip. But here's the deal. We're working on that now. I know in the past where I've talked about this. So, well, you know, I think it should be commercial free. And in essence, it would be. I'm working on an advertising plan that would benefit both you, the listener, and me, the podcaster. That would actually help keep a couple of bucks on the plate and allow us to do what we do on a lot more of a regular basis. It's just something that we have to consider. You know, it doesn't. It's not. I mean, it's cheap, but it ain't free to put it all together. And there's hosting fees and things like that. So, one of the ideas that we're kicking around is we'll be getting into a couple of different types of sponsors from when we're not actually out in front of an audience. And those days that we actually are in front of an audience, what will more than likely happen is that we will bring in an actual front paying client, which would be kind of a cool thing to have happen, and you can be involved in that on a really inexpensive level. If you're interested in that sort of thing, you can let me know. You can contact me through rickcheddar.blogspot.com. There's ways to reach me right there, up on Facebook, on Twitter, all the usual social media places as well. Our thanks to podbean.com for taking care of the hosting of this podcast. They don't do it for free. There is that. And, of course, my blog, of which I've mentioned, at rickcheddar.blogspot.com. We're also found at stitcher.fm, stitcher.com, player.fm, and many other directories. You can find them at our website, rickcheddar.blogspot.com. So there you go. I'm going to mosey along. We'll catch you all next time. Thank you again for subscribing. Please tell a friend and share this episode or the whole series with whoever you'd like, and we'll catch you later. I'm Rick Cheddar, and this has been From Radioland.